context of a definition of rural subsistence rights, which are labeled as those rural rights to subsistence is labeled as being available both to non-native and native practitioners of subsistence in rural areas. The other aspect of ANILCA, which is spoken of in terms of the legal right and basis, is the invocation or the speaking to the constitutional authority of the federal government through the what is called the Commerce Clause for exercising a trust responsibility to Alaska Native peoples. So here too then is spoken. ANILCA once again then confirms in many Alaska Native viewers' eyes that fundamental federal responsibility to the protection of Alaska Native subsistence rights. These grounds then are what I perceive and to be the kinds of grounds that are normally advanced in the context of the discussion of the basic rights. Those basic rights key back into that definition of subsistence, what subsistence is, why it is that people want to protect it. And with those introductory remarks, I think that we can explore those basic issues with the audience.
Thanks very much, Steve. Maybe just before we leave you, you could indicate in what regions of the state of Alaska you think the subsistence economy, subsistence activities are still most prevalent. Is it possible to state that?
Well, the subsistence economy is everywhere existent in one form or another. In terms of the numbers of people directly supported by it, it is probably most vital from Western Alaska, from Bristol Bay on north, all the way around to the Canadian border, and in the villages of interior Alaska, where these populations are fundamentally, their existence depends upon their ability to produce from the naturally occurring resources. Let me make a couple of other demographic remarks, which I think you were leading to here, and that has to do with the size of the Alaska Native population that is presently covered by the protections of ANILCA. Because the protections of ANILCA, speak only to rural Alaska Natives, based upon the 1980 census, it covers approximately 75% of the Alaska Native population is covered under that ANILCA requirement. That means approximately 25% of the population is not covered by those provisions because they're currently residing in what are defined as urban contexts.
Including the moral rights, the cultural rights, and the legal political rights should also be used in terms of the question that you asked him in terms of the economic identification. To simply identify a subsistence way of life based on the economy is looking at only one aspect. I suspect Steve's answer should cover all the other definitional regimes that he described.
Yeah, Woody. In discussing the definition of subsistence, I think we should begin first by discussing the people, native people. And I'd like to, at some point, distinguish the difference between how natives perceive subsistence and differentiate it from non-native peoples. First of all, native people, by the mere fact they're not white, are a racial minority. But we enjoy something more, which is a political definition that native individuals are members of specific political entities to whom they owe their primary allegiance. And this is considerably different from a racial minority. And Native people are indigenous to the land, being here from anywhere to 30, from 3 to maybe 30,000 years. And also, being indigenous to the land, I would say, means that the people are part of an ecosystem that involves involving an intimate interrelationship between human, plant, animal, and environment. And this usually manifests itself in a functional system of beliefs, and traditions. And so subsistence is more than an economic system. It's the embodiment of spiritual beliefs, community traditions, which are inextricably intertwined with social, political, economic, and historical aspects of the lives. And this system is articulated by the native languages. The native languages are not mere accumulations of words, but over the thousands of years it took to develop the native languages, each specific language describes the special relationship between the people who speak that language and their environment. System, but the totality of a system of beliefs and practices that not only describe the people's relationship to the environment, but also, I guess in a Christian sense, you would say the relationship to God. In Haida, we have a word we call Sunkhanawai. I'm not too sure if I've pronounced it correctly, but the closest definition that I could find was the power of the creating that's on the wind, which means that the power that went into creating the universe, went into creating animals, went into creating, say, this table and me, was all the same. Therefore, we are related. So everything is I am related to everything, everything is related to me, I must treat them with respect, which is, I guess we'd contrast by the traditional Christian belief, and I don't deny it, that God gave man dominion over the earth, over the water, the fishes of the water, the animals of the land, and so on. So I think we have to look at this in terms of more than a mere economic system, and also distinguish the difference between indigenous people who have long traditions of involvement with the environment and the non-native people who view hunting and fishing, for the most part, their rights come from the English common law, in which wild animals belong to the sovereign until reduced to possession. Then the sovereign has the right to determine by what method and whatever other management practices that individual may reduce that wild animal, be it bird, fish, whatever, to possession. And so there we have a major distinction between how we perceive our rights to these resources and those that come over from Europe. And also, if you take a look in most dictionaries, hunting is defined as the pursuit of game for sport or food. So there's no spiritual basis in there. There are no moral values articulated in that definition. And fishing is merely the act of attempting to catch fish, or of actually, well, fishing doesn't mean you catch anything. It's kind of like shopping, you know. You go and you take a look, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have anything. So I'd like to, I see Caleb has something to say.
Yeah, Caleb.
Perhaps I can expand a little bit on what Woodrow had just said. That the laws that have been passed regarding subsistence, the priority law, the ANILCA and the Marine Mammal Protection Act, our reactions to existing situations that the laws were passed because the people were doing these kinds of activities. And yet, many of these laws are not suitable to the existing situation. And I think that's something that we in this panel and the people in the audience should be aware of, that if you go to a village and ask them what is the bag limit for ptarmigan, they won't know that. If you ask them for seasons, they won't know that, because they're dependent on availability. The village people normally don't react to the regulatory regimes that are in place unless somebody comes in and tells them you can't do it. And also that some of the methods that we use for gathering subsistence resources, it's perhaps not the most efficient means of gathering. You can probably seine tomcod and get a lot more than fishing through the ice. But a lot of it is the effort. If it wasn't for the school system, where the people had to move into the village, I think that we'd see a lot more people scattered out over Alaska in pursuit of subsistence or living the lifestyle that they lived before. So this is something I think that we should be aware of as we discuss the situation here.
Thank you. Rosita.
Yes, with the broad definition that we have, that Native people have of subsistence, and I think a couple of people have already addressed the cultural significance of subsistence, I think it's incumbent upon this body also to spend some time focusing on urban natives and the exclusion of urban natives from, in the legislation.
Woodrow.
Yeah, I'd like to continue on with what Rosita was saying there. I think for a working definition for subsistence, the closest I could come to would be people deriving sustenance from the land, which goes far beyond any economic definition. And also in the concerns of the Native people who live in the urban areas, one of the things about being members of these specific political entities, which we'll call tribes or bands or whatever the terms you want to call, they have this little thing, this little spark that makes them different from racial minorities that we call sovereignty, which means that they as a group have rights that I would say are given by Creator, and that regardless of where any individual member of that tribe may reside, the case law of the United States, I believe, has found that regardless of where that individual may be domiciled, that he is never considered, or she, to have abandoned the group, the tribe, or their home, unless they do it by some specific positive act, so that regardless if they live in Anchorage, in Fairbanks, whatever rights accrue to the tribe accrue to that individual. And what has happened here in Alaska is the Claim Settlement Act is trying to disperse us into or reduce us down to a mere racial group rather than a political definition. I think if you look in Section 2 of the Claim Settlement Act, one of the things stated in there is that the Claim Settlement Act was not intended to create any permanent racially defined institutions, rights, privileges, or responsibilities. Well, for one thing, we are not racially defined, and I think that should be made clear right from the very, very outset. And the other thing is that, as Caleb said,
your rights are political in origin. That's the point.
Right. Rather than being just the rights of a racial minority. And also that, I lost my train of thought here.
Sorry.
So anyway, these groupings, this political identity goes far beyond the mere grouping of individuals, say associations or that sort of thing. And so I agree with Steve that times have changed, technology has changed, but then when you take a look at the regulatory practices, the state is tying technology to this right to derive sustenance from the land. I think probably later on we'll discuss the state's creation of a new category called personal use that I, for one, have been unable to find any legislative language
that would give rise to that category, nor anything in the regulations, the present regulations. But again, that personal use is based on technology. Also, it's been, subsistence has been tried, people have tried to tie it to economics to create a welfare situation, and I think Steve articulated that in his paper. But our whole system of beliefs came under attack very early. The Christians coming from Europe had a mandate to go out and missionary unto the world, which they did. I'm not attempting to point the finger or saying they're wrong, but I'm saying this is what happened. And so the first thing that this attacks then is our subsistence way of life, because then it changes the whole perception of people's relationship to the environment, and also the destruction, the willful destruction of the languages by Sheldon Jackson also played a very major role in also destroying this identification and involvement with our relatives, I'll put it that way. So then that puts us where we are right now, but I still would like to have a discussion on the on ensuring that everybody understands that our rights are political, but they're also God-given, rather than the rights accorded by a mere sovereign, as was with the English common law.
Tony Vasca, you started this off. Have you anything to add to what has been said by Woodrow and Caleb?
Sure. Basically, I think what Woodrow and Caleb are saying is there are a lot of factors involved in the definitional aspect of trying to deal with the subsistence law. I think Steve's approach in identifying what those general identifications are that that we use to identify subsistence, actually do exist. And what the roundtable discussion should be looking at is whether in fact the political system as it's being used to identify subsistence uses can in fact take into account the moral aspects of subsistence, the cultural aspect, and the economic aspect. The political system as it exists uses the economic aspect only because it's the easiest methodology to allocate resources among competitive users. That kind of a discussion is vastly different than an identification of those uses by a specific group for moral or cultural uses. It's vastly different. And yet, I think the legal political system is too exact in its identification of allocation of resources or management of resources, because the management schemes are too tight in terms of how they regulate individual users. And the difficulty in taking care of an individual user of any resource at the expense of a larger population is very difficult, and it's very difficult for any political system to or management system to do that. And I don't know of an example whereby an individual is taken care of specifically by a management scheme so that everyone is viewed to be treated equally. That just doesn't exist. And I suspect we can find a lot of examples in this state and perhaps in the North where that happens. How the legal political system as it exists identifies cultural uses is not something that I can speak of intelligently, but it's something that people in the villages, native people in the state, identify with very heartily and express it as such. The fact that Rosita brought up the urban natives is a valid example of native people living in the urban areas who in fact are tied, perhaps not economically or politically, to the use of those resources, but certainly culturally. And when I, as an example, when I'm living in Juneau during the legislative session, you know, I welcome a visitor from Bethel who's bringing me something from home to eat. And it's something that I'm tied to, and I suspect that most Alaska Natives living in urban areas do identify in that fashion. It speaks to the personal relationships that are tied by those specific individuals to their homeland. Those are tough, those are almost impossible to regulate or write statutes for. And you just don't do that. If you examine closely the two sets of, the two most obvious sets of laws that deal with subsistence, the Alaska National Interest Lands and Conservation Act and the Alaska State Law on Subsistence, you'll find that the legal system is restricted severely in how, in fact, it can take care of the state's population and people who are inextricably tied to a subsistence way of life. The law, in fact, tends to identify subsistence not so much as a way of life, but a lifestyle. And whether the people in the state of Alaska or the United States can frame a statute to go around the constitutional constraints of identifying Native peoples as exclusive users or different users of those resources, I think at this point it's difficult. And I think that a lot of us who think about these things would certainly, can certainly write a statute today identifying subsistence users as Native only. But we didn't. The constraints by the state and federal constitutions are more powerful than we are. Dave Case would take it to court, and the courts would decide that that was unconstitutional. Dave Case, as an example, he wouldn't do that.
I guess it is my turn. I guess I had one point I wanted to bring up, but let me respond to what I think you were saying, Tony. I guess I don't think there is a constitutional problem with Native-only subsistence in Alaska or anywhere else in the United States. That is not a federal constitutional problem, and the federal constitution could clearly supersede the state constitution. What was the problem is a practical political one of, it seems to me, as to whether in 1980 it was politically possible to protect Native rights in the political sense that I understand Woody to be talking about them in Alaska. And I'm not sure that whether that was possible or not at that particular time, but the negotiations and the enactment of ANILCA is on the premise that the political cuts that had to be made with Alaska and Alaska's representatives in order to get that law passed couldn't accommodate Native political rights in the sense of Native rights to hunting and fishing. Now, I think it should be we should perhaps in the course of these next few days find out what the political situation has been elsewhere recently and why, where I believe other kinds of subsistence regimes were adopted that were for Natives only. But because Native Americans are not a racial minority, they are a political or political communities, it is not unconstitutional to treat them separately. But I think there was a political, practical problem at most in 1980. And perhaps the awkward question we're asking now is, was that wrong, and will it work? The other point I wanted to ask Steve and others about was the, and I think it goes to the practical ability to respond to the deep cultural, spiritual, and even economic needs of a Native people. And that is the need, as I saw Steve describing it, to maintain the flexibility of the harvest. And I would appreciate it if you could, I think it would be useful too, to expand on what you meant by flexibility of the harvest, or perhaps other people who are more familiar with the subsistence way of life could explain whether or not it is important to have flexibility in harvesting and what that may mean.
Well, I think Caleb, when he was discussing how it is that people in the villages relate to the regulatory system, was expressing it very well. The institutions and the knowledge of the villagers adjust to the resources that's available. When certain resources are in abundant supply, they're made use of. When they're not, other resources are sought out. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's birding season doesn't open until September 10th, according to the Migratory Waterfowl Treaties, or not. You go out and you subsist on the resources that's available to you, given the knowledge that you have about where they're going to occur, when they're going to occur, and at what times you want to be able to make use of them. I would also make the point, a point about the language and the codification of long-term information and knowledge about what those cycles are over generations upon generations of people who pass down that block of knowledge to their offspring. And it is that entire corpus of knowledge, not merely the monitoring of the resources at any particular time, but also the taking into account of what other kinds of possible arrangements can be used in certain times, that makes for that flexible arrangements. And in closing that remark, this is one of the serious concerns that I think confronts people, is the problem of that flexibility is seriously hampered by many of the regulations that are presently in force. And unfortunately, certainly in a certain segment of them, those having to do with the codification of the term traditional within the subsistence regime on national parks, there is a great concern and fear that it will not adequately reflect the necessity of this kind of flexible adaptation, moving in when fish and game populations are elsewhere. It unfortunately might lock into place a system which does not have the same kind of flexibility which these village populations have used in long-standing customary and traditional practices. I think Caleb spoke to that very well.
Yes, Harold Spark. For the taped record, I'll take the liberty of mentioning your names as each of you speaks, and that's only so that the person typing this up will know who is about to address us. So please, Harold.
I wanted to go back to what Caleb had said, because I thought he put his finger on a very important issue, and that is the legislation that we have now is one of orderliness. It was proposed to address short-term problems that had become politically untenable, and both ANILCA, specifically the state subsistence law. The village populations are opportunists. They have to harvest what's available. Recently, we've been talking about the fact that if you have to look at economies, my wife's village requires about $2.2 million to operate now the households. Its private economy is about $280,000 this last year. That means government makes up the difference right now. There are a lot of former luxuries which are now necessities in that village. They do not have the wherewithal to import protein. The flexibility of their harvest is absolutely essential. But when you look at the federal legislation, you look at the state legislation, it does not consider the flexibility. It is almost site-specific, it's temporal, it's spatial. It says we only know what is a problem now, and we can't consider what is a problem in the future. At this time, again, I live in Western Alaska, so I have to reference Western Alaska. We're going through a period of intense ocean conversion. We're now sharing our resources with the oil and gas industry. The federal government couldn't care less about, I'll quote Secretary Watt, 45,000 people living in Western Alaska. Are you silly? Should they control federal policy? When we learn from our elders, we learn of the time of starvation and of habitat loss, flooding, storm events, ice overrides, which remove the habitat necessary for the wildlife to reproduce that the people depend upon. The subsistence systems that the elders always tell us about is one in which not only do you care about the principal species which are being harvested now, but you always set aside in your bank those other species that were harvested in the past when the prime species were lost. And I think, you know, Caleb was quite correct of pointing out that this orderliness is temporal and is not very, very well founded. If the government gives away the tomcod, which are a important species for a period of time now in the fall, in the past when there were no birds, these very same species were the food source for the spring. So when we go to, and the government doesn't know that, either the state government, the federal government, its laws and legislation, this government could very easily sacrifice those resources now. Let's say in this year, 1984, the industry, oil industry, can say that's a cost to us. We don't want to pay that cost right now. The government says, fine, we don't know what the villages know. We'll give away that resource. In 1988, 4 years from now, let's say the resources which are harvested in the spring aren't available and the people would have to go to tomcod. They're not there. You know, who suffers that loss? Who was penalized? Well, definitely wasn't the new industrial users. It definitely is going to fall on the backs of these, as Watt was saying, these 45,000 people who live on the shell of the far flungs of America, who don't matter in the national politic or don't matter in the state politic. And that is a important question about flexibility. And I hope as we go through this period of days that this issue of where is the overall well-being of the in the future of these rural communities is going to be founded in. It definitely cannot be founded right now with the existing legislation. Thank you.
Marie Adams.
I would like to first of all thank you for inviting us to participate here. I think it's very important for us to consider things that we need to consider in coming up with a definition of subsistence, because in dealing with the whaling issue, the definition of subsistence has been a critical issue. And I agree with Rich Woodrow Morrison that subsistence should be looked at, tying it to our cultural, nutritional, and spiritual needs. And this is one thing that has assisted the Whaling Commission in dealing with cultures that did not understand what traditional subsistence was. And if it wasn't for this tie, I don't think we could have gone very far from where we started out from. I think it's important that we look at that, and whatever definition that we agree to here, I think will have an impact on other resources that we're all dealing with today.
Joe Meeker.
While we're still involved in the process of understanding what subsistence means, it's probably worthwhile to have a little perspective on it that goes beyond the time scales we've been talking about. Yeah. What we're calling subsistence has been the way of life for most human beings throughout the evolutionary history of our species. It is the subsistence way of life was the dominant way of life over at least 1 million years and perhaps up to 4 million years. as our species was evolving. It was from the subsistence way of life that our present mental capabilities, our present social instincts and relationships, our emotional lives, the entire body of what we individually and as a species and as communal members have inherited, it all grew from the subsistence lifestyle and way of life. The other lifestyles that are competing and that are now overriding that lifestyle are very, very recent by comparison. Agriculture and the domestication of animals are no more than 10,000 years old. The Hebraic tradition is around 4,000 years old. The Christian tradition around 2,000 years old. The humanistic culture we're talking about is about 400 years old. Modern democracy is 200 years old. Industrial society is 100 years old. High-tech life is, and the nuclear age, is around 30 years old. So we're dealing with relatively minor periods of time for all of the traditions that are, that seem to be dominating the discussion and that are certainly dominating the policy and politics and regulatory bodies. In the larger sense, though, what each of us is as a human being, what all human beings are, grows out of the subsistence way of life. It doesn't grow out of post-agricultural culture, and it doesn't grow out of industrial culture. It's perhaps worth remembering that.
That's a thought-provoking statement, Joe. Any preliminary conclusions you want to draw from it?
Well, there are a few things that we can say, I think, growing from that, that the subsistence way of life is an extremely complex systemic way of life. Most of the other additions that have been added on in the past 10,000 years have been attempts to simplify. Agriculture is a way to make hunting easy, or a way to make gathering easy by planting only one crop and keeping other crops out. The domestication of animals is a way to make hunting easy by restraining an animal and modifying its habits so that it's easy to approach and easy to kill and eat. Our tendency over the past few thousand years has been to move towards simpler structures, which yet proliferate, and so they become complicated. And modern industrial culture is a complicated society, whereas most subsistence ways of life are genuinely systemically complex ways of life. And if we can make a distinction between complexity and complication, I think that too might be useful at some stages in our discussion.
Well, maybe I could just suggest what has emerged thus far. It seems to me that clearly there was in Alaska for thousands of years a society that arose out of subsistence. Its moral, spiritual, and economic life was integrated with the requirements of subsistence. That society still exists. Yet the laws that govern that society, the laws made in Juneau and in Washington, D.C., and treaty arrangements relating to whaling and other marine mammals that are made by conventions arrived at by any number of countries, those laws, coming from a different tradition, as Woodrow Morrison has suggested, have the effect of undermining the native society founded on subsistence, because those laws don't take into account the fact that there is a whole web of moral and spiritual and economic relationships founded on subsistence that a whole society depends on. Rather, our laws are formulated, and I think this is so in all the Western countries, on the basis of individual rights. So subsistence laws, rights to take fish and game are by and large passed with the idea that there are a lot of individuals out there who don't necessarily belong to any special group, native or non-native, and those laws are designed to limit and to qualify the subsistence rights of those individuals. And that has the effect, I think you have all urged, of undermining that long-standing subsistence way of life out there. Now, David Case has assured us that if the law, the federal law at least, were to acknowledge that collective way of life dependent on subsistence, and to guarantee and assure its survival by, if need be, limiting rights to take fish and game to native people only, a subsistence preference for natives only, if federal law were to do that, it could not be successfully challenged under the Constitution, since those rights are derived from the fact that that society existed before the USA was established, and so its rights are political, not racial. And it seems to me that that's as what has emerged thus far. If I've maybe I could invite Larry Spengler of the Attorney General's Department or Steve Behnke of the Subsistence Division to offer their views. I don't know whether on behalf of the state of Alaska, but any views you wish to express, please, Larry.
I agree with Dave Case that federally there would not be a problem. Constitutionally, there would not be a constitutional problem to identify subsistence uses through the use of the native criteria. The state constitution, under the state constitution, that would not be feasible, and then the result would be, whether it would be good or not is a separate issue, the result would be the federal government would be in charge of managing the fish and game. So that is one limitation or one consequence of that choice. I'm not sure whether this is a useful clarification or not. There's the implication of some of the discussion has earlier, or maybe it was just in Steve's paper, is that there are four named communities in the legislative history of ANILCA that are named as urban communities: Anchorage, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, and Juneau. And the implication is that the rest of the state is rural. That's not exactly the way it works. The four named communities were listed as examples of urban areas, and then subsistence was to occur in rural areas for rural residents and customary and traditional uses. The way that has been implemented is through a set of eight criteria. The state has adopted eight criteria to identify subsistence uses. The criteria are listed in Steve's paper, and they are such things as long-term, consistent pattern of use, patterns of sharing, exchange networks, traditional modes of preparation. As the subsistence law is implemented at this time, what would happen is the Board of Fisheries or Game would look, the State Board of Fisheries or the State Board of Game would look at a particular area or community and determine whether or not that area or community qualified, whether the uses of the resources in that area or community qualified under the eight criteria. Then if they did, then subsistence uses would be authorized. If they did not, subsistence uses would not be authorized. There's a presumption that, I mean, Juneau, Ketchikan, Fairbanks, and Anchorage would not be included, but there are communities that are sort of middle. They're not the villages out in the very obviously rural areas, there are places like Kodiak, Sitka, communities in between size that depends on, that are not automatically rural. It depends on what the analysis is of the A criteria. And they have not been applied throughout the state. This is an ongoing process. They were applied to the Kenai Peninsula, and the Kenai Peninsula was found not to qualify. So this is just a little clarification on how that works. Whether that's good or not is a separate question, but simply by taking the populations of the four named communities and adding them up, those are not necessarily the only Native Alaskans that would not qualify. For example, the Kenai Peninsula does not qualify for subsistence fishing, and that is not a named community in the legislative history.
Just one point you made, Larry, about the state constitution. I take it the state constitution provides that fish and game resources are the common property of all the people of Alaska, something like that?
Yes. And that all people shall be treated equally with regard to race, creed, or color. And the state has taken the position, at least so far, that although the federal government has a special relationship with Alaska Natives as a political entity, the state does not have that same relationship technically, and so cannot negotiate as a political group, or cannot treat Natives separately as a political group.
Thank you. Steve Behnke.
Thank you, Justice Berger. I wanted to mention that I'm basically here as a resource to explain how the state is involved with subsistence issues, and also to learn and to listen. There have been a lot of interesting things tossed out here. I also wanted to mention that my job as director of the division, which is responsible for compiling information throughout the state about subsistence uses, my job would be a lot easier if there were some way to define subsistence uses in terms of native interest. But